Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. This is the last weekend to catch the Broadway production of Teresa Ribeck's play, Bernhardt Hamlet, which showcases the legendary stage celebrity Sarah Bernhardt, who famously set out to conquer the role of Hamlet in 1899. Think about it, a woman playing a man in a revered Shakespearean role in 1899. Last month, I talked with Tony Award-winning actress Janet McTeer about her title role as Sarah Bernhardt. She spoke about the play being a love letter to theater and why Bernhardt originally spearheaded her lead part in the male role in a time when women just didn't do that sort of thing. Let's take a listen.
When you first encountered this play, what did you think?
I was sent the play to they wanted to do Teresa and Moritz and Todd, who runs the Roundabout, wanted to do a reading of it, and I sort of opened it and skimmed through the first 10 pages the way you do, because, you know, I was busy, and I thought, hang on a minute, and I got to page 10, and then I went back and then started again, and went, by the time I got to page 20, I'd already emailed my lot and went, you've got to let me make them do this on a day that I can do it. I just thought it wasn't ready then. This was, I want to say, last November or something. And maybe a bit later, I'm not sure. Anyway, so we all got together and we did a reading, and I loved it. And Moritz and Teresa, and Moritz, who's the director, mm-hmm. and myself and Teresa got together, and we just went, we have to do this. It'd just be so much fun. And so, you know, so then we did it. Then we did, and she wrote another draft, and we all got together and had dinner again. And then she wrote another draft. And then we did a workshop for 3 days where we all sat around sort of with her. And she's so fast. She's amazing. She just sort of rewrites things on the spot, and she's brilliant. And then so we were all sort of putting our thoughts on the table. And then we found a slot that we could do it, which was now, which was the time that we were all free. And here we are.
That's so interesting that you saw the manuscript in its nascent form.
Yeah.
You didn't see the finished product.
Mm-mm.
Not product, but the finish. It's a completion.
Yeah.
What changed in the character
the
way?
I think if you'd asked Teresa, well, there's, what changed? I think a lot of the structure of the play changed. I mean, the themes haven't changed. All of that is still the same. I think there's a lot of my humor and my kind of energy and stuff in there. People who know me say it's the most like me they've ever seen me on stage, which isn't to say I'm not Sarah Bernhardt, obviously, but I think it is my humor, it is my energy, it is my quixotic nature, I guess. And she sort of incorporated all of that, and we had a vast amount of fun in rehearsals. We just sort of mostly laughed from, you know, 10 o'clock in the morning till 6 o'clock at night. And she did a lot of rewriting, and we were still getting tweaks and rewrites until the third week of previews of her. So it was definitely a challenge. All I did was learn lines and have fun, but...
You mentioned about your physicality in it. The first time we see you on stage, you just take it. You just come downstage and you just take it. And I think it's interesting, and I've read about this, your height. You're very, mm-hmm. very tall.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me a little bit about how you use your height and your physical stature mm-hmm. in this play? Because you're slight, but you're very tall.
Yeah. Well, the good thing about playing someone who really lived is that... if you don't look like them at all, then you don't have to worry about it. Because she was small, and she was slight, and she was flat-chested, none of which I am. That was kind of... It meant that I could just go, well, I'm just going to abandon that. There is no need. The only thing mm-hmm. I've done to try and look like her at all is the fact that she had notoriously, ridiculously frizzy hair and masses of it. So I do have that. We don't even really know what color it is. So... was. And in the end, I just sort of thought, well, what would I do? What would she be like if she looked like me, if she had my physicality? And that's all you can kind of go with, really. And every time you use your... I mean, the advantage of, I have always found, in being sort of relatively extreme in terms of my height and my physicality, and I'm a very physical person,
yes,
is that all my characters are 6 foot tall and all my characters... look like me. So it's all about how you use it and how you feel about it. So, like, for example, when I was playing Shakespeare in the Park, I sort of...
Great. But,
thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed it. That was immense fun also. Fun is the meaning of life, really. But yeah, so with that, I was kind of really, you know, I used to follow men down the street and watch the way they walk and really kind of try and look all those old rockers. That was what I was trying to do with him.
Yeah.
Whereas with her...
I just wanted for the audience, you were playing Petruchio and Taming
yes,
the Shrew.
Yeah, and I was playing a man and I sort of based him on Keith Richards and all those other guys. And so with this one, I felt like she would have... she would have the poise and the posture of a woman of the 1890s who, you know, they in general wore all those kind of clothes. So she would have good posture. She would have good, she would be elegant. She was famed for her gestures and her hands. And so I tried to sort of incorporate that. But I think she also felt very freed by all these guys' parts. So I try and use that with the striding around the stage and stuff as well. What was difficult, actually, is that she was sort of, in many ways, the mother of naturalism as acting. And when you look back on some of the things that she's done, the snippets that we can see on YouTube, for example, it wasn't naturalistic at all compared to our standards. So what you have to do is kind of try and interpret that physically somehow so that you're being modern naturalistic whilst also trying to still look like you're in the 1890s. So I'm trying to walk that line somewhere in there between modern, very modern, you know, when you're in your bathroom, everybody moves like a normal person. Mm-hmm. And when you're on stage in a Victorian dress, you move with a certain kind of way. So I'm trying to do all of those things. And then when you're in your Hamlet costume, you're trying to sort of look like a guy. But of course, I can't be a Keith Richards because he didn't exist. So, you know, what her guy would still be actually relatively upright. And so it's a sort of funny line to cross, line to walk.
That's a lot going on.
Yeah, and so
that's
I'm thinking about...
a lot going on.
I know, no wonder I'm tired.
In the play... Sarah wants to be in control of herself, of the costumes, of the script as she's producing this Hamlet. And it is said in the middle of the play, a woman with power is a freak. Mm-hmm. And I saw it just a few days ago and the audience kind of inhaled like...
I know. It's great, isn't it?
That is... It's so amazing. The Times, the New York Times said, it is so clever, it's so timely, it hurts. Can you share what you think is relevant about Sarah Bernhardt trying to play Hamlet that's relevant to everything that's going on today?
Well, I think what's so amazing about the play, and if people who are listening haven't seen the play, I don't want to spoil it because I'd love for them to come and see the play, is that it is a romp in many ways. It is great fun. It's a love letter to theatre. You know, it really is. Mm. You're watching these actors trying to understand what Hamlet is, trying to do that and what that means, and as well as a woman who spearheaded something way before her time. You know, she played many of the male roles in the end, and because she got bored of the fact that there weren't any, you know, great roles for women, and she did that in the 1890s, you know, and she went on to do it. She bought her own theatre, she ran her own theatre, she did all of these things by herself. And that was, you know, in a time when women just didn't do that, and she did, and she didn't care. She was an amazing self-promoter. She was, you know, she's always depicted as eccentric. I'm not totally convinced by that. Personally, I think she was just, you know, in a time before internet and Twitter and radio and anything else, how else are you going to get yourself out there? How else are you going to get people to want to come and see your stuff if they don't see you in the newspaper doing something interesting or whatever? So I have, you know, quibbles about that. But
so she had control of her image.
Yes,
in
exactly.
a way that we think about exactly. people doing today, in fact.
Exactly. But only through a very slight mm-hmm. kind of window. But I think the play then goes on to really kind of, and again, I don't want to spoil it if people want to come and see it, but in, you know, there is a theme of misogyny and mm-hmm. The parts that women are given and how she feels about that and what she's going to do about that. And, you know, actresses now, women now, how women are perceived now. I don't think that's changed. The wonderful mm-hmm. part, which always people always get a big reaction when she talks about, the audience give a big reaction when she talks about that particular point, always makes me happy, always makes me feel I've done my job. And you know, there's something else that's really interesting, is that often on matinees we have people who have travelled from far, and sometimes they're an older crowd. Mm-hmm. And I particularly love those shows, because there was one wonderful show where we had, I think it was last Wednesday, we had in the orchestra, we had an older crowd, definitely, and then up top we had some schools.
What a great mix.
It was a fantastic mix, because you could hear on the audio, you could see all the really kind of highfalutin, powerful political stuff. The kids were kind of, yeah, you know, really kind of, and the girls were whispering, wow, you know, and all that. And then there was a lot of sort of really more muted, but real kind of, oh, ho, 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 ho. You could hear a lot of women kind of go, oh dear, oh dear. You know, they could really, yeah. And I thought, those women have lived through this, you know, a lot of this. It was really, and they were getting points that perhaps some of the younger people weren't getting. It was just, it was a really lovely, lovely contrast.
Yeah, juxtaposition between the two. We're speaking with Janet McTeer. She's starring in Bernhardt Hamlet at the American Airlines Theater. The two things in the play, and we won't give too much away, that Sarah Bernhardt doesn't have control of: her married lover, her passion for her married lover, mm-hmm. not the gentleman, and her money. So as you were putting this role together and creating this life for her, how did you reconcile her being so capable and such a bold person, and then two things which are sort of stereotypical about women: you can't control money, and you're too emotional.
I found them both shockingly easy to the thing about her with her money is that she made tons and tons and tons of money, and then lost it all, and then made more, and then lost it all. And I do know someone in particular who has done that, and I'm not like that. I come from really normal, you know, English hardworking stock, so you look after your money and you watch your pennies and your pounds and all that stuff. She wasn't. She came from absolutely nothing. I mean, and when she was young, she was a whore. That's how she learned her. That's how she earned her living, on her back or sitting up or however mm-hmm. she did it. But that's how she earned her money. And then she turned herself into this, you know, amazing person. And so I think there was a sense of, you have it, you get rid of it, you make it again. And I think I do have a friend who has made millions, lost millions, mm-hmm. made millions, lost millions. And so I felt that you just have to feel like it's not a commodity. It's just sort of something that comes in and then goes out, like weather. And you lost it, you'll make it. You lost it, you'll make it. So there's that side mm-hmm. of her. And I think in terms of the her lovers, I feel like, you know, we don't know whether she really did have an affair with Rostand. We don't know. We know that she loved him dearly. We know that they remain great friends. We know that he was one of the friends who were in her little tight circle of her inner circle. He was there. He was one of the last people to visit her before she died. Hmm. And in fact, his wife became, who is also in our play,
yes.
became one of her great friends. So I think for the sake of the her character, I mean, she had affairs with everybody, and she was only married once, and it was a disaster, and he was a monster. So my personal take is that she was somebody who, she had no parents who loved her. Her mother wasn't interested in her. She farmed her out to aunts and nannies and whatever. And her father, no one knows who her father is. So what does that do to a child? I think it gives you a hole in your soul. And I think she had that. I think that's why she loved her son to distraction, and they remained great, great friends. He's also in the play. And I feel like people who are like that often don't really, somewhere deep down, there's a little black hole, there's a little bit missing, a little vulnerability of, and somehow they often end up in relationships that don't work, or people who are unavailable, perhaps. Or, here's the other thing, or I feel like there are some people, myself included, actually, who have very good instincts, and they are with people, and they go, you know, it's just not the one for me, and they move on. That's what I did. Mm-hmm. I did that for, I never wanted to get married. I did it for 20 years. You know, I've had some wonderful boyfriends, lovely times, lovely lovers. And then I met my husband the second I met him. I knew he was the one.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I was 45 or whatever. I don't know. I don't even remember. 46 maybe. And I cannot see that ever changing. He was just the one for me. So, you know, I look back and I go, I just hadn't met him. And I wonder whether she was like that, that she just had super good instincts, that there are people she loved and people she didn't. And interestingly, all her lovers, apart from almost all her lovers that we know about,
that we
I'm
know.
Sure there were many more, remained great friends. She remained great friends with them. And I don't know, I just, so I think that I mull with those two mm-hmm. kind of ideas, because obviously you mull with different ideas on stage every night, so to keep it alive and fresh for yourself. So I flip between those things. But I think that's where her vulnerability came from. I think she was, that's why, you know, she had a motto called con mem, which means, that was her motto in life. And in English, it kind of means against all odds, or regardless, or nevertheless, or whatever. And I feel that was her motto, because, you know, I'm going to do this, and I don't care how much it costs, and I don't care how hard it is, and I don't care. Sod it. I'm doing it anyway, regardless. And I feel that she really had that, and I love that about her. And I think that says a lot, that's her motto, that I think that's also, con men was regardless of everything, regardless of how scared she suffered from terrible stage fright, you know, which was, again, people often think that she was such a kind of, oh, she was never terrified of anything. She was. She got terrible, stage fright. So I think that I try and bring all that onto the stage to make her a fully rounded person, not just this magnificent, marvelous diva that she probably was.
One of the central themes of the play is, is it appropriate to make changes to something as classic and revered as Hamlet?
This is a really a thorny subject in the play, because we keep saying, you know, she wants to take out the poetry. What's tricky, of course, is that up until then, you know, we have to remember she was French, so Hamlet was translated anyway, and previous to her doing it, it was the fashion was all very floaty and romantic and very, you know, and she believed it should be just more active, much more
muscular,
more, just more driven. She didn't want to wander around being floaty and poetic, and I think that's essentially what it was. And in actual fact, her Hamlet was longer than a lot of the translations that had been so far, and unfortunately we don't have the text. But, you know, it would have been translated from English into French. She clearly didn't like it, you know, so then she was retranslating it. I mean, not that long ago I did Mary Stuart, which was originally in German. We translated it, you know, it's been translated many times into English. And then when we did it, we commissioned another translation. So that's the way it goes. So I'm kind of all for it, you know what I mean? And I'm totally with her. And a lot of the kind of, I believe he's a 19-year-old boy and all of that, that was me and Teresa, you know. I've spent,
well, it's hilarious. They have this discussion about how old poor Yorick is,
yeah,
and how old Hamlet can be, and Sarah Bernhardt's convinced that he's a teenager.
Definitely, and I am 100% convinced that he's a teenager. I absolutely am. I totally believe that this is a kid who has never experienced grief. He's never experienced depression. You know, how grief and depression can move one from the other. He has no idea how to cope with any of this stuff. And to me, it's just so spectacularly obvious that he's a young kid. I don't see how anyone can see he could be a grown-up. That's ridiculous in my view. I'm totally with Sarah on this. Or whether Sarah's with me, I'm not totally sure.
Last question, because I want you to save your voice. I don't want to do this to you. I could keep you here all day. And I think you answered it a little bit, but I do want to ask it. How do you, Janet McTeer, as an actress, actor, and a creative, feel about changing things that are classic and that are in the canon and that have seemed untouchable?
I have no problem with it at all. None at all. It's been done a million times. Why not do it in different ways? I mean, why not? I mean, Taming of the Shrew that we did, all women in the park, we slashed it to bits and made it 90 minutes. So what? Someone else can do the four-hour traditional version, you know? Why not? I mean, if it's a brand new, this is a brand new play that we're doing now. And, you know, maybe at some point that will be changed. But these are plays that have been done thousands of times. So what? Honestly, so what?
Janet McTeer, thank you so much for joining and coming down to the studio. This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Welcome back. We just heard the great Janet McTeer talk about stepping into the role of Sarah Bernhardt on the Broadway play Bernhardt Hamlet. We want to remind you that this Sunday is the last day to see the production. It was written by my next guest, acclaimed playwright Teresa Rabeck. In 2004, Rabeck was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize for Drama, and she's won numerous awards for her work on NYPD Blue. She's the author of three novels, was the creator and showrunner for the NBC show Smash, and her stage work has earned her the distinction of being the most produced female writer on Broadway in our era. Rabeck joined us for a few weeks back to discuss Bernhardt Hamlet, which opened September 25th at the Amsterdam Airlines Theater. Let's take a listen to that conversation. I love this play. I saw it. We had Janet here.
Oh, great.
She was spectacular. How long had you been thinking about writing a play about Sarah Bernhardt?
I actually thought about it for probably 8 to 10 years. The idea came to me quite a while ago, and I carried it around with me. It sort of immediately presented itself as something that would be interesting to write about, but then I didn't know quite how to enter it. And sometimes I do think about things for a long time before I write them to see if they, you know, if they hold up, if they continue to plague me. Finally, I had a friend say to me, you know, you've been talking about that a long time. Why don't you just do it? And I had the opportunity to go to a writer's retreat out at U-Cross, Wyoming. It's a Sundance writer's retreat. So I had 3 weeks that just presented itself to me uninterrupted.
And, that sounds amazing.
Oh, it was amazing. It really was. And I could really just put everything else out of my mind. And by that point, I had read a lot of books about her. I had read a lot of her own writing. I spent a lot of time looking at pictures of her. She's someone who there's a lot of... there's a lot of writing about her, but it's contradictory and mysterious. And she was apparently a famous liar. And she was also someone who people were deeply fascinated by. She was a real celebrity before celebrity actually existed. She was one of the first great showbiz celebrities, and so there was a lot of myth around her. But what doesn't seem to change is the images of her are so powerful and electrifying.
Seems like she might have been sort of a Gaga-esque,
yes,
Madonna,
oh, I think that's
reinvention
a great,
kind
yes.
of woman.
Yes, she kind of rose out of nothing. You know, she was the daughter of a courtesan. She was apparently being raised to be a courtesan, and then her mother didn't have the patience to deal with her when she was quite young. She was Jewish, and her mother gave her over to a convent full of nuns who took her in hand. She was apparently quite a volatile child, And
which probably meant she was just a strong-willed little girl.
Yes,
back in that volatile back in
all
that.
Of that. And then she sort of liked those nuns and really was getting along there. And then her mother came back and took her out again. I mean, she never knew her father. She made up a lot of stories about who he may have been. There's no evidence anywhere that anyone had any idea really who he was. Then she kind of goes through a period where you don't quite know what's going on, and then suddenly she's a star. I mean, she did end up at the Comédie Française, and she was famously kicked out. This is when she was a teenager, and she was kicked out almost immediately because she slapped another actor. But they let her back in, and then the rest is history. But she really is very self-created, you know.
It's interesting you said that you focused on some of her writing. What was her writing like?
It's very florid and full of feeling, and it's performative. There's something quite wonderful about what she thinks she should sound like. It's great and quite brilliant. Some of it is really astonishingly smart, and I've included pieces of it in the play because I thought, yeah, I needed her actual voice in there to guide me. And also, some of the things that she says are so smart, you'd be crazy to leave them out.
As you describe her life, there are about 15 plays you could write based on various portions of her life and different experiences she had. What was it about this particular experience of her deciding to play Hamlet that you decided to make that your focus?
You know, people are still perturbed by the idea of women playing Hamlet in all ways. Women are curious to do it. It's something that is noted every time it happens. There were other female Hamlets before hers, but they were not celebrities. They were so she was the sort of the first celebrity to take it on. And I have to admit that the crack into figuring out how to write this play started to appear when, to me, inside my head, when Benedict Cumberbatch was doing it. There was such a thrill, there was such a worldwide obsession with seeing Benedict Cumberbatch do it. And to me, I realized, and then, you know, just a couple years ago, Oscar Isaac did it, and that there's an element of a frisson that kind of enters the situation when a famous person does it. And there's some idea, so that for me became a way in, that it was something that when a celebrity takes it on, it's got a different texture to it. And that she was somebody who understood that. She was probably one of the first people who understood that. And that it also happened at a time when she, the more time I spent reading about her, it happened at a time when she was aging out of all the parts that she had been playing. And she was at the top of her craft, she didn't want, and the parts weren't there. And there is a moment in the play where she says, many of the male parts I would have liked to play Mephistopheles, Tartuffe, and that's straight out of one of her letters that, you know, and it's still an issue today. So all of those things kind of coalesced into, for me, a way in, because also a lot of the time that I'd been thinking about it, I thought I wasn't interested in a biopic. I was interested in, on a certain level, I know a lot of actors, and I became interested in what it's like to take on Hamlet. You know, it's famously difficult. So I had all those pieces in place, and I started talking to people who had done it to hear about what it felt like, where the traps are, where the frustrations are, where the differences are. You know, that for me, the way into telling the story of her doing it was about the sort of literal rehearsal process. And then once I was standing inside that, I realized, and just talking to people about it a little bit, I realized that many people don't know who she is and they don't know about her life. And so a lot of the facts of her life started folding into the play itself, that it's not just about an actress playing Hamlet, it's about this person actress. And who she was and why she needed to play Hamlet and what it meant in the time. And, you know, and also as part of the research that I was doing, it became clear that, you know, she had this very powerful relationship with Edmund Rostand, and they were they performed the role of being a muse to each other for quite a long time. And there's and I read so much about her. There's conflict. Some people feel like, oh no, they never had an affair. But I don't agree. And it's up for grabs whether or not that actually happened.
We're speaking with Teresa Rubeck about her play Bernhardt Hamlet. So there's something I'm dying to ask you. In watching the play, Sarah Bernhardt clearly knows who she is. She's a smart woman. She's a canny woman. She's savvy. She's bossy in the best way, in the best use of the word. She has two weaknesses: passion for Rostand and money. She's not good with money in the play. First of all, was she good with money in real life, and you decided that somehow she needed a weakness?
No, she was terrible with money.
Oh, okay.
She was famously in and out of a fortune. You know, but
because that's one of the tensions in the play is like, can she afford?
Can she pull this off? Yeah. And, you know, like, I really enjoy the scene between her and her son. That's also terribly accurate. He actually did. She wanted to keep him around. She put him in charge of her money. He lost all her money. The only person more with money than her was him. All that stuff is most of the stuff in the play is pretty accurate. Mm-hmm. But she sort of famously would run through all her money and then go on tour to America where she could make a bundle and then go home and run through it all again. And then for a while earlier in her career, she could run through all her money and then do Camille a little bit and pack the houses. She was very, very desirable in the role of Camille.
That was like her greatest hits.
Yeah, it was her greatest hit of the first half of her life. Mm-hmm. But so she was pretty... she was pretty resilient, you know, and I don't think it bothered her that much. I mean, at least that's certainly the person that she was famously generous. She spent all her money on her friends. She threw these grand dinner parties and like sort of and took care of people when they were sick. Very, very, very loyal, faithful. Mm-hmm. I admire her tremendously.
Did she lose focus because of her passion? Her love, the love of her life? Was that something that...
Oh, in this moment?
Yes.
I think, you know, that part of the story is very much this play.
They're super sexy together, the two actors. Yeah. They really are, you know?
Yes, they're a pretty good organism out there. I think that we went through a lot of discussion around that. I think that they deeply loved each other and deeply believed in each other, but that there is always this, and still to this day, it's something we really struggle with, is how men perceive women as other and whether that makes us less. And that it was interesting to me that even a woman as mighty as Sarah Bernhardt would face that perplexing truth. How that would show up. It is true that he was writing all the facts that he was writing Cyrano when she was doing Hamlet. Those facts are true. And she did end up doing Roxanne at one point later on. But it became curious to me that he would see her that way at a moment when she was taking on this very, very mighty and complicated task that she sets herself to play Hamlet.
We're speaking with Teresa Rubeck about Bernhardt Hamlet, the play that she wrote. It's at the American Airlines Theater on West 42nd Street. There's a moment in the play that obviously you didn't write this in the past 6 months.
Right.
So there's this moment when one of the critics says, a woman with power is a freak. And I think I saw it right around the Kavanaugh hearing time. And the whole audience was... And it's sort of a laugh line, but at the same time, it just felt too real in the moment. How does it feel for you when you hear it now, given you wrote it however long ago?
I think a lot of people think that. I think men and women think that. A lot of the things that people say in this play are, I studied Victorian melodrama when I was in graduate school. I actually
got a PhD, didn't you?
I got a PhD.
Dr. Rubeck,
right.
I'm sorry.
And those thoughts and statements are very accurate to the period. People really, I believe that they're still accurate, frankly. Not, I mean, not to everyone. I think we've made a lot of progress, but that part, you know, I actually, you know, sometimes when things like that come out, I think, oh God, that's how they saw, a lot of people saw Hillary that way. You know, a lot of people really judge Nancy Pelosi of this kind of crazy rage. And I think, mm-hmm. why are they so mad at her? And there's something about a woman with power that a lot of people find deeply offensive. And that's, you know, I'm not making a political statement about that. I'm just reflecting the fact that there are still people out there who believe that. As a dramatist, that's what you do. You have people say what they're thinking. I think people think that. Yeah. They certainly did then, and I think some people do now.
I want to ask you about two more projects before I let you go.
Yeah.
In a Man's World, kind of. The segue.
Yes. Yeah.
It's a Gamergate themed comedy. Can you tell me more?
Mm. It's about a woman who is a very, very talented gamer. And she's worked hard, and she's her husband's a stay at home dad. And she's got her own game finally at this company. And it's a sort of action game for girls. And it's coming together well. And it people are excited about it, and some of the men at the company where she works decide they can't handle it, and they fire her without cause. And then to cover their tracks, they invent stories about her being difficult, and there's a kind of backstabbing thing that goes on, and she can't get another job, and it's very terrifying to her. I mean. This has happened. It's a little bit autobiographical. Some of the producers who approached me with it had gone through it themselves and felt like they needed my expertise. So it's for YouTube Red. And I don't know if I need. Anyway, she finds a way to both go undercover and take revenge on the system. And it also covers a lot of the ways people feel out of power in workplace environments and feel like, you know, that the world is kind of fragmenting all of us into different identities, and that the identity that everyone still wants to be is a white guy. But within that, there's a lot of conversation between, you know, her and her husband and her brother and her brother's black girlfriend and her transgender friend. I mean, because she eventually goes undercover as a man, and everybody has an opinion about this because it is sort of a reverse Tootsie, but Tootsie doesn't actually cover it anymore. It's like there are so many different ways to have different gender and identities that it becomes sort of a farce and a heartbreaking examination of identity in the workplace.
And that'll be on YouTube Red.
Yes, and it's funny. It's actually very, very funny. So
I can believe that. And this is the best description. One more question. I'll just control one more question. You have another play.
Yes.
About to come our way. And it was described as a bracingly creepy family drama.
I think that's accurate.
Starring the Dailies.
Yes, Tim and Tyne Daly, who are brother and sister, I wrote a play for them to play brother and sister, and essentially the play is about things aren't going so well for Tim, and so he goes over to his sister's house and he sleeps on the couch in her basement, and then her husband says, how long is your brother going to think he's going to sleep on the couch in our basement? And that's kind of the whole play. It goes from there a little bit, but it goes into, that's another one that's about identity and love. It's very much about love between these people.
Where's the creepily part?
Well, you have to come see it. No, the love is good. The love is what saves them, but the creepy part is definitely there.
Well, we've talked about theater and YouTube Red, streaming service. Do you have any desire to go back to TV? Are you done?
I haven't thought about it for a while. I'm also working on a spy movie for Jessica Chastain. And,
a part of her production company or her as an actress?
No, she's in it. It's called 355, and it's Jessica Chastain and Marion Cotillard, Penelope Cruz, Lupita Nyong'o, and Fan Bingbing. It was a big deal at Cannes. They sold it, and right now I'm in the middle of that. So that's what I'm in the middle of right now, and I'm living in the present. Yeah.
Do you ever stop working?
I slow down, certainly. I had a back problem this year. And that slowed me down and focused me. So I'm happy. It doesn't sound like I've slowed down, but I'm sort of more focused on myself and my family and getting the job done.
Well, take care of your health.
Yeah.
And take care of your family. Yeah. We come back when Downstairs is up and running?
Absolutely. Come see it.
Teresa Ribick. Bernhard Hamlet is currently playing at the American Airlines Theater on West 42nd Street. Thank you so much for joining us on All of It.
Thank you.
Welcome back to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Comedian and writer Ziwei Fumudo was recently profiled in Forbes Under 30. She's currently a co-host for the podcast Hysteria on Crooked Media. That's the Pod Save America, guys. As well as a writer for Vulture and was a writer on the late night show The Rundown with Robin Thede. Ziwei hosts a bitingly funny web series, a talk show called Baited with Ziwei, where she verbally paints her guests into a corner. And you can see her live regularly at Union Hall in Brooklyn for her live show, which is called The Pop Show. Ziwei, welcome to All of It.
Oh my gosh, thank you for having me. Hi.
Hi. So what is The Pop Show?
Pop Show is where I make people listen to my pop music that I write and record. It is a fun time. I play my hit singles Ponderosa with Omarosa from Melania to Sri Lanka and Make It Clap for Democracy.
What do you say you make them?
I have a Swedish producer. His name is Zdenko. And we record in his basement pop songs. It is insane and fun and so lively.
What is your audience like?
My audience is just a bunch of rowdy people who are excited to have fun. Like Britney fans, people who are...
Britney fans who are into politics.
Exactly. Politics and pop culture. This is the point, the moment, the intersection.
Do you write with them in mind?
The pop stars
audience? Your audience.
Yes, I write with them in mind. I think, how can I torture them? This is all for my live show. Mm-hmm. So every song that I record is to get the crowd bumping and moving and laughing.
Now you have a big holiday extravaganza coming up.
I do.
Can you give us a preview? It's going to be on December 7th, you said?
Exactly.
In Union Hall.
Yes, I will be performing Jingle Bell Rock a la Mean Girls. So you can get excited for that visual. I have a lot of secrets. I have some special guests. I will be performing Silent Night. It's going to be a wonderful time for me and hopefully the audience.
You seem pretty fearless. Like you're just,
you
just go for it. Is there something that is hard for you to do when you perform, something that does make you a little frightened?
I get a little frightened before I go on stage, but on stage I feel so free. Like this, I feel like I'm doing what I was born to do because I don't know. I just get electrified by it. It's better than any drug, that's for sure.
You know, I went on your LinkedIn page because I'm a nosy
like that. Oh, my LinkedIn? I don't use that at all.
I know, but you know what? You went to fancy pants schools. You went to Phillips Andover Academy, and then you went to Northwestern. How does this, having this like...
Wow, this is like a job interview.
I'm sorry?
This is like a job interview.
Well, a little bit. How does having this heavy-duty education play into your work?
I come at it from a really heady academic perspective, and then I dumb it down to the lowest of lowbrow.
So you're doing the highbrow lowbrow thing?
Oh, I love highbrow lowbrow. Yes, that's why I love watch Real Housewives because I think it's like Shakespeare of our time, even though it's definitely not. Yeah.
You originally studied poetry, is that correct?
I did study I was like a hipster beatnik. So I studied like poetry, I studied African American studies, I studied film, but I started school as a math major.
Oh, that's interesting.
I know, isn't that random? I love math because I had a very lovely teacher named Mr. Hurley in high school.
Isn't it funny how that teacher who you can remember their name.
Truly.
And how they made you feel. Not necessarily what they taught you, but how they made you feel.
Oh yeah, I didn't learn anything in that class. I was just staring at him. I was like, wow, adults.
So what was it about poetry that drew you to poetry?
Oh, I love language and I like, I think poetry and comedy are kind of similar in that it's about the economy of words and how you can like say sharp things really shortly. Poetry is just my first love. Yeah.
So how did you make this? So you're sitting at college. You're thinking, what am I going to do? What am I going to do with myself? Who am I going to be? How did you decide to shift from math, poetry, all this hardcore academic stuff, and then make the shift to comedy?
I was a lazy student, so that's how I got into poetry, because I couldn't read books quickly, but I could read a poem and then like talk about it very confidently in class. So that was my way to do less work and get the bang for my buck. Mm-hmm. And then I just realized with poetry, you can't get paid.
You can't make a living. It's hard, very hard.
Yeah. So I was like, what if I did television instead? And so I did this internship at Comedy Central, and that's kind of how I got started. I was in Chicago with Northwestern, so I interned at IO, which mm-hmm. was like Improv Olympics, and I interned at The Onion, and I kind of just started doing comedy from there, and here I am, confident.
What did you learn from your internship at the Comedy Central? Which show were you on?
I was on a rotational program. It was called The Rock Turns, Chris Rock Turns. And the reason why I did it is because I heard that Donald Glover did it, and I'm obsessed with him. I do follow him. So I wanted to be just like him, and so that's why I did that. And it was a rotational through like on air, off air, like Daily Show, Colbert Report, and so I got like the taste of the mm-hmm. comedy in the industry, and I really liked the writing part. I was like a very chatty intern, so I talked a lot, and yeah.
What did you learn about the business of comedy that you maybe didn't really understand as a student in college?
That you have to work.
Yeah, that's a lot of work.
You have to actually try and get up and work and write a lot. I didn't realize how much you have to write, but yeah, I spend most of my day writing. Jokes to myself and laughing to myself in a room by myself.
We're talking to Ziwe Fumide about her career, and I really want to talk about your web series because it's very interesting.
Oh my gosh, thank you.
Baited with Ziwe. It's awkward and funny at the same time. Explain to people the premise.
This premise is that I race bait my friends and family. Yeah, I make them talk about race. It makes them very uncomfortable. They squirm, and I enjoy their disgust.
Where did you get the idea for this, to bait your friends and family?
I think it's it's a part of my personality to ask too many questions and to talk too much. So I made it into a web series.
All right, let's play a clip so people can get a sense of what the show is about.
Welcome to Baited with Ziwe. I'm your host, Ziwe. This is a show where everyone gets reparations if everyone is me.
Still funny.
Just kidding. If you're not border racist, it's taught. So we're going to take a trip down memory lane and see when my guests learn to be racist. Please welcome my white friend, Matt Rogers.
All right.
Gullah Gullah.
How's it going? Oh, hello.
You're supposed to say Gullah Gullah back.
Gullah Gullah.
Don't do that. So where did you grow up?
I grew up on Long Island.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
How many black people live in Long Island?
I would say many black people live on Long Island.
Can you list them all?
No.
Give it a try. Tarek? Malik?
I'm sure there's a Malik.
Wow, that's racist. Baited.
You just paint people right into the corner.
I really...
You lead them right in.
I bullied him. I'm an antagonistic woman. What can I say?
Have you ever had a friend really turn on you during this?
Yes, Gary Richardson personally attacked me during the web series. It was really funny, but I was trying to bait him. He writes for SNL. He's really funny. I was trying to bait him, and he just refused.
He's a black guy. Yeah.
He's a black guy, Gary Richardson. And... I tried to bait him, and he just was not having it. Mm-hmm. And so he baited me. Yeah, I'm still trying to recover from that experience to this day.
Has there ever been anything you said on the web series that you later on regretted?
Oh, no, I edit it. so I'll cut it out.
Now, you also, I mentioned in the intro, you had experience as a writer for The Rundown with Robin Thede, which was a very funny show on BET. What do you like better, being in front or being a writer?
I like them both. Mm-hmm. They're both parts of my personality. And performing makes me a better writer, and writing makes me a better performer.
Oh, that's interesting. How does the performing make you a better writer?
Because there are things that you find while you're on the stage that you include in your writing. And it's just an interaction and a dialogue between your audience. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like learning as I perform with them, and they give me energy, and I use that in my writing for sure.
And I have this last question I have to ask. It's a pop show. You are self-described as the princess of pop.
Oh my God, thank you.
But the New York Times, the fact checkers wouldn't let that go.
They would not.
Tell me about this conversation.
I don't know. I was not in the room for that. If I was, I would have argued with it until I was declared princess of pop, crowned. I am Meghan Markle of pop music. Yes, thank you. You know, it's an oversight, and I hope that will be corrected in the next issue.
What's next for you? What's your next big thing?
What's my next big thing? I have no clue. I'm just making it up as I go along. But I am dropping a musical album.
When's that?
Maybe in February. I have a pop show festival June 1st at the Bell House. Yeah. Follow me on social media. You'll find out what I'm making up as I go along.
It's interesting. You're also political on social media.
I am political, yes. Yeah. As a black woman, you kind of just have to have open eyes because I'm directly affected by this. My parents are immigrants from Nigeria. So I just feel it in my heart that I have to speak out. Yeah.
Because you have the platform to do so.
I'm lucky enough that people will listen.
Yeah.
So I might as well speak.
Z-Way Fumide, it was lovely to meet you.
Lovely meeting you. Thank you for having me.
And you can see Z-Way's pro show, pop show, December 7th at Union Hall in Brooklyn. You've been listening to All of It on WNYC. We'll see you on the other side of the news.